Today's guest says a nation asleep is a nation in danger. We'll see why in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. And I'm pleased to introduce to you Tracy Brame. Tracy graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point with a degree in political science. Since then, she has earned master's degrees from the Kelly School of Business and the Thunderbird School of Global Management. Now she is the owner of West Point Financing. Tracy has devoted her life to exposing the coercive methods of white supremacists in Indiana. Tracy, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Tracy, before we get into the bulk of the story that you have lived and are living, tell us a little bit about where you were born and how you grew up.
Okay. I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. My grandparents, I was sick when I was born. I was a sick child. And my grandparents took me in and kept me most of my life. I lived with my mother for 1 year, but mostly my grandparents raised me. My granddad was a Pentecostal preacher, and we had rules and more rules, is what I'll say. Some of the grandchildren didn't like the rules, and I personally did. I felt they kept me safe, and so I appreciated the rules, and was very close to my grandparents and my mother. Even though I didn't grow up with her, she was like a best friend, and I certainly had a close relationship with my mother.
Give us a sense of what some of the rules were living in that household.
Girls were to wear skirts and dresses if they were in the church. If you weren't in the church, you could wear pants. We did not go to worldly events like baseball games and football games. And I remember for 1 year before I went to West Point, I went to Duke University, and my next door neighbor had been a cheerleader in high school, and she came up to me doing a cheer. I thought, I mean, her arms were going different ways, and we can win. It's just like, what's wrong with you? You know, I had never seen it before. And she said, I'm doing football cheer. And I said, well, I didn't go to football games when I was in high school. And she just dropped out on the floor. She couldn't believe that somebody had gone through 4 years of high school and not gone to one football game.
I would imagine that the cheerleader costumes were a bit stunning for you to see as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, why do you have to dress that way to say we will win?
So, you know, so the clothing, the makeup, the jewelry, the way she carried herself, all of that was a complete mystery to you.
It was. It doesn't matter what her name is right now, but she was very much a strange bird for me. But we're friends on Facebook, and you know, she posts, well, she's a lawyer now. And she posts a lot of civil rights type comments, and I think it's fantastic that she found a place for her voice, because she certainly had a voice in college.
Interesting. What was Duke University like for you?
It was just a strange place. I was out of my natural ground, I guess. I just didn't feel comfortable there. I worked out most of the time because I was trying to get back in. I was trying to get into West Point, and you needed to do a specific exercise to get through past the entry team on West Point. And so I worked out most of the time, and then I talked to her, my next door neighbor, a lot. And I didn't care for Duke. So what I did was, Duke has two campuses, an east and a west. And there's about 5 miles between them, and I ran that every day in order to kind of escape being there. I didn't care for it at all.
Before you got to Duke, what were your thoughts about what your life would be like?
I had thought about law school. I had thought about medical school. I graduated with like 3.8 GPA in high school, and according to my guidance counselor, well, first of all, I got into every top 10 school in the country. My guidance counselor said, it doesn't matter what you're gonna do, whatever it is you wanna do, you can do. And so I just put off making decisions as to what kind of grad school I'd go to. I just knew I wanted to go to West Point. Even when I was at Duke, I was planning to go to West Point.
Why West Point?
It just seemed tough. It seemed tougher than Duke, and it just seemed like there were rules and structure there, and I liked the uniforms, and I thought, you know, these people, what I mistakenly thought was that there are no problems there. You know, there's a lot of drinking at a school like Duke. Whenever somebody wins a football game, somebody gets drunk and climbs a tree and puts toilet paper on it, you know. So there's a lot of that at regular colleges, and I didn't fit into that. So I wanted to go to some place with more structure because it would feel like home. It would feel like home to me.
So it sounds like it would feel like home. It would feel more predictable. You would fit in more. You would get it more. And they would get you more.
Right.
So tell us about your initial attempts to get into West Point. Easy sailing?
No, actually my first time I applied, I applied to 10 top 10 schools in this country, and I applied to West Point, which wasn't in the top 10. And so I applied to 11 schools. And,
that's a lot of essays.
Yep. I got in all the top 10 schools, but there's a something called a flex arm hang with West Point. You have to hold yourself and your body weight up on a bar for a length of time, and you're graded by how much time you can hold yourself. Now, I could do push-ups all day long. I could do like 50, 60 push-ups, but I couldn't do the flex arm hang. I couldn't hold my weight up with that muscle group. And so they wouldn't let me in. They passed on me my first time.
Wow.
And so I went to Duke, and I joined ROTC to compensate. And I figured whatever they were learning the first year at Duke, I could learn at ROTC, which isn't true. And then I just worked out constantly. And my instructor said, you'll be happy to know that when you transfer in, you don't do the flex arm hang, you do push-ups. And I said, then I'm going to get in. He said, oh, you're definitely going to get in. I'm so happy, but still, even though you're happy, you worry about it because what if they change their mind? You know,
right.
I had this quirky little rule that was out there, and so it applied to me. I still, to this day, cannot do a flex arm hang very long. I can't do pull-ups very well, but I can knock out push-ups.
Gotcha.
It's just a different muscle group, and so I was judged on one muscle group the first time and a different one the second time. And you know, it's so funny, my instructor was like, what are you doing? Why are you hanging from the bar all the time? Trying to squeeze my flex arm hang. He's like, you don't need it.
So that was a relief, right?
Yeah.
So the second time was the charm.
Second time was the charm for me.
And you got in. How old were you?
Probably 19.
19. So here you are, 19. You're leaving Duke. You're going to West Point. Life was good.
I thought it was a good trade for me. I didn't fit in at Duke, and I was fit at West Point, and I didn't understand the rules at West Point, but I thought they were there to protect me. But some of the rules at West Point are there just to harass you. And that's not me saying anything bad about my alma mater. I don't have much bad to say about my alma mater. It's just that there's a lot of hazing. I don't think they'll ever get that out, especially when officers go to sleep at night and cadets stay in the building. So, you know, when you have that, that's a ticklish thing for not only West Point, it's a ticklish thing for the Army. When the cadets, when the soldiers are in their barracks, there's a lot of the rule is based on their age group, not common sense or some Army rule. A lot of the rules, when they're sort of alone monitoring each other, is based on the age group.
So I'm not sure I understand. So if you're a cadet and you're up to, let's say, 25, are the rules different if you're 30 or 35? I'm not sure I understand.
No, I'm saying that when you have a bunch of 19-year-olds
okay.
at West Point or in the Army telling each other what to do when they are alone in the barracks at night, you're going to get a different set of rules than you get when the captain's there during the day
okay.
telling everybody what to do.
Makes sense. And hazing happens, unfortunately, you know, in colleges across the land, unfortunately.
It does. I mean, they're usually young people who don't know better, and so they're making up things to do to humiliate each other. And that's where the problem comes in, because they haven't seen what that humiliation does to another person, and two, they haven't cared. So you're going to get some strange situations that come about both in the military and in the civilian world.
The hazing that you experienced, looking back on it, what do you say?
West Point is still a predominantly white male environment. So when you talk about age group and those types of hazings, you also have lines on race and gender. And I received my dose of both gender and racial harassment at West Point. I think everyone sort of does. The harder you try, is almost the worst things are for you. When grads take new people over to the side to talk to them about going to West Point, what a grad tells somebody they want to do well, they want to see you well, is keep your head down, keep your mouth shut, and keep your hand down. Don't volunteer for a lot. Don't stick out at all. The way you get through West Point is to stay right in the middle and just graduate in peace. But if you try hard or you know, try to excel or something like that, a bunch of guys are going to look at you and say, "Who is she?" And they're going to come out like little dogs nipping at you, trying to pull you down by your ankles. So if you can handle that, go ahead. But if you don't think you can handle that, it may be shocking for you.
So on some levels, that just seems so opposite to what people outside of West Point think of when they think of a West Point experience or a West Point grad. Would you say that's the case or no?
It is the case, but I stand by what I said. When a West Point grad takes someone to the side to counsel them on how to get through West Point, they're going to tell them not to stick out, to stay in the crowd. It's easier there, and you won't have any problems, and you should graduate fairly easy. But if you constantly try to, you know what it's like? Oh, how did I not say this before? If you take one crab and you put the crab in a bucket, and the crab wants to get out of the crab will crawl out of the bucket. If you put 12 crabs in a bucket and one tries to get out, the others will pull it back so that no crab gets out of the bucket.
And that's what it's like.
That's exactly what it's like.
And would you say that is because you were black or female or just there?
A lot of it's because we have some race, we have some gender issues in our country. But when you couple that with youth and this kind of idiotic decision-making skill, it kind of compounds, I think. I don't know if I say it gets better once you get to the civilian world, but it's different in the civilian world. This brash boys thinking that there's no way that a woman's going to outdo me. That's a different mentality than an older guy thinking the very same thing, but he might be more reserved in his expression, because in society there are repercussions for him doing that. At what point, when you're kind of alone and no one's watching, you can get away with more.
That sounds kind of scary.
It sounds kind of young.
Okay. Fair enough. You were there for 4 years?
Yes.
And you had some very interesting experiences and challenges while you were there. What was the advice that was given to you by Cadet Twig?
Kind of what I just was talking about, that you don't want to stick out. She told me, she said, you do not want to stick out. She said, first of all, I'm telling you, too late, because you're already here. And I was scary fit, is what I had been told by my age group, that I was scary fit. And so I'm excelling at push-ups. I'm doing more push-ups and sit-ups than the guys. I'm running faster than most of them, not all. You know, there's always, you know, a fit guy can outdo a fit woman sometimes. If he's fit, but if they are just average, women who are really fit can really go neck and neck with a guy, and so you know, and that makes him feel less adequate, even though he knows that he didn't prepare to come to West Point. He kept drinking to celebrate.
I see.
And he got there, and now he's not fit, but he's still angry that he's there to make a showing for his dad and his grandfather, and there might be a woman just running a circle around him. That's frustrating. And so her advice to me was, don't stick out. Try to fit in, like that middle crowd. And what I had done is I had already tested into some harder classes, some advanced classes, and that really was tough, because when our freshman year started, I not only had, you know, cadet classes, but I had some sophomore classes too, and they required more study and thought because I hadn't seen them before, and it was tough. And she was telling me, I wish I had talked to you first to tell you not to test into these classes, because it's going to affect your GPA for the rest of the time you're here. Whereas if you had just stayed put and taken the easy classes, I still was in the threes for West Point. I was still, you know, in the threes for my GPA. But she thought I could, she said, you have the potential to be like a 3.8 or 9. And if you just stick with the easy classes that we have.
That's really interesting advice. Tracy, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to start with your sophomore year and how things changed as you moved into your sophomore year. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Stay right where you are. There's much more to learn about Tracy Brame and her life. Take care.
Thank you.
Tracy, talk about your sophomore year in at West Point. What was that like?
I think what happened my sophomore year is that we had more freedom, and so we could come and go. And what happened with me was that my roommate, obviously another female, had more interest in guys than she did with books. And we had learned that my freshman year when I was forced to tutor her to help her graduate from freshman year to second year. She was flunking out. So she became my roommate, and I think what she wanted was a tutor whenever she wanted one, and she wanted to have a guy party just about every other time. And it wasn't working for me because I had a lot of studies to do, and I was still in advanced classes. So we tended not to get along very much, which kind of stoked the guys because they thought, aha, now he's got something to get her on. So they kind of used some of that young mentality on me again. But
Tracy, let me ask you a question. You said you were forced to tutor her. How did that come to be?
A cadet, an upperclassman, walked into my room and ordered me to help her get through final exams. Now, I had final exams in tougher classes, but she had studied all year, and she was going to flunk out, and I was ordered to help her pass the class.
And so you had no choice.
Really, looking back, I could have just ignored him, but when you're in the moment and you're
right,
you're a freshman and you get the classmen bossing you around, then you really don't have any choice but to make room to listen to what's going on with her and why she's not making it, and try to make some actual items that she can do to save herself, is what I said. You know, I'm going to give you some things, different ways of looking at things, so that you can save yourself, because I'm swamped. So, you know, I had to listen to her and figure out what she didn't know and help her.
Just what you needed, one more task.
Yeah, it was like another class or added on. I was doing her classwork. I wasn't even in her class. I tested out of that class. So, I mean, that's why they said, you help her. And I'm like, well, I don't know how they're teaching her what her problems look like anymore. I haven't taken that since high school. So I just really didn't know. I just got through it with her.
There was a cadet. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name. Was it James Jones? How do you pronounce the cadet's name?
James Jones. He came into the picture because he could see, one, he saw what the white males were doing to save her. And then he also knew, he was also a great student, so he knew the last thing he would want to do is take on her problems during semester exam week. And I had said my sophomore year that I wanted to go into politics, so he was very astute about that and just took interest. He showed interest in me, whether he took interest or not, he showed interest in me, because I had said that I wanted to go into politics. And he thought that was interesting, is what he said. But what I would later find out is that he found that repulsive, that a black female would want to go into politics.
Now, was he white or black?
He was black.
He was black. And you made an interesting distinction that he showed interest, but you weren't sure that he actually took interest. That's a really interesting distinction that I'm not sure enough people make when they're evaluating relationship potential.
Well, if you look at the relationship that developed between us, there are some guys who align themselves to women so that they can tear them down. I mean, it's a game for them, and that's pretty much what he did. It's sort of a psychological thing, actually. You might be a better person to know what it's called, but it's like a psycho thing where they get close to a woman in order to try and destroy her. And they actually enjoy moments where she is hurt or struggling. It fuels them somehow. I don't even know what that mentality is called. But it might be called psychopath. I'm not sure. You could correct me if you're wrong, if I'm wrong. But it's he had those issues deeply ingrained in him.
So this was a man who hated women, sounds like what you're saying, and certainly didn't have a whole lot of good feelings for himself, but used you as a way, he thought, to bolster himself. Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean,
okay.
I would definitely say that he... It's funny, it's hard to say a man hates women when they need them sexually, because if they really hated them, they wouldn't even have sex with them, you know?
But well, that's not actually true. Yeah, yeah. You can hate a woman.
There are men who really think that women are below them,
mm-hmm.
and should be below them. And you run into that mentality at West Point because of the bravado of West Point and the fact that women have been there for such a short time compared to a century or so or more for guys. And so it's funny that you have a mindset that you don't think women are equal, you don't think that women are worthy, and yet you need to marry one and you need to date one in order to for your own personal reason, even though you want that she is not your equal.
The world is indeed a complicated place, and there certainly are men like that, and it certainly sounds like he was one of those. He was very cruel to you.
To say the least, yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the things that happened between you and James Jones?
He ended up graduating and going to California for a language school, defense language training. And he was supposed to learn Greek in order to be stationed in Greece. And that weekend, I wanted to go home and be with my family, but he insisted that I come visit him for some reason. At that point, we were engaged. And so when I went out there, what had happened was there was a gentleman in my barracks who had taken some drugs and was running around the barracks scaring people. And I called the officer in charge, and they dismissed him. And he cleaned out his room. When I told James that, he seemed to think, well, he got sloppy, is what he said. He was always sloppy. Meaning, if he had hidden his drugs better, he would have been okay, and he would have graduated.
That's an interesting response.
It is an interesting response, but I didn't, having not been around people who do drugs, I really didn't have I didn't have any, if I didn't go to football games, I certainly didn't go to drug events.
Gotcha.
So he invited me out there. It was sort of urgent. He wanted to see me. And when I got out there, he raped me. And what happened to my brain when he raped me was that I proved two things. One, I have dissociative amnesia and it's immediate. And two, I have shock, which also is immediate in the moment. I literally woke up the next morning from a horrific rape, I would say. And my mind was clear. I didn't really understand where I was, but I looked over and saw him and thought, well, we must be in California. I couldn't remember. I didn't even try to remember anything because no one said, do you remember last night? Nobody asked me that. And he was waiting to see what my reaction was. The shock was deep. I mean, I erased several days in that moment to literally not remembering anything probably until I had before I had been on the airplane to go out there. So I really didn't have the capability to protect myself in that room with him when I woke up, nor in the room with him the night he raped me. I mean, I wasn't able to protect myself for the rape, and I wasn't able to protect myself the next morning because I literally could not remember the rape, and I could not remember him as my attacker. And that is sort of the definition of dissociative amnesia. It is the most perplexing about shock. Sometimes shock people can remember stuff, but when you have dissociative amnesia, it goes away until your body and your mind is capable of dealing with it. And that could be a week, it could be 10 weeks, or it could be 10 years. Right. It's just what your brain needs in order to cope.
It in fact is a protective mechanism.
Right.
And what you later learned was that he had actually inserted instruments into you. I mean, he had done a great
right.
deal of physical as well as emotional damage.
I was torn up on the inside. I mean, literally, if he had actually pulled all the way through an internal membrane, I would have died. And he was okay with that. And what I learned later, but didn't know then, is that he was angry that the guy doing drugs was kicked out of the academy, and that I was the one that got him kicked out of the academy. And I would have never made those connections.
And in fact, you weren't the one who got the guy kicked out of the academy. The guy got the guy kicked out of the academy.
Well, precisely. I mean, it was either then or some other time. I mean, he was getting
right.
to a point where, he was wild in that barracks. That and people couldn't hold him down. Like other cadets were trying. They were, I don't know if you call it the buddy system, or again, we talk about the youth, but they were trying to push him into a room and hold him down, and he would not be held down. He definitely wanted to hang out in the rooms with the women. So I mean, I just watched him over and over come out of these rooms like a madman, like a bull. They couldn't pull him, and they were holding him by his waist and everything. They couldn't. And I'm just thinking, something's wrong. And then I looked into his eyes. His eyes were like gray. And I thought, oh, they might be bigger than normal.
Yeah.
And my mom might be right. My mom had taught me how to tell if somebody was high, because I didn't really know. And she had tried to explain it to me over the phone. And James was upset they were friends. So he was upset that that guy got kicked out.
The horrifying things that you went through with him, was there an ending to the relationship with him? Did it continue? What happened?
Once we got to, well, keep in mind, I walk away from the trip to California not knowing that I was raped. When I got back to school, I felt like I was going to pass out. So I made a decision not to go to formation. Instead, I went to the doctor's office, and the doctor realized that I had been raped. So when he asked me, "Were you raped?" I said, "No," because I couldn't remember being raped. I had dissociative amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't remember being raped. And so I didn't know that James was my aggressor. So I kept, I kept seeing him. I married him. I went to Fort Bragg with him. And there were times where he would bring it up. But this is the thing. When people bring up things that you have, your mind has blocked, your brain translates it into static. Your brain is so smart. It's protecting itself, and it's refusing to let you hear or understand issues surrounding what's blocked. I have this disease, but I'm telling you, that's phenomenal.
It is.
It's phenomenal. I give the brain all the credit in the world.
So he would bring this up to see if you actually remembered, and you just looked at him blankly, it sounds like.
I had no idea what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, what's really interesting is that sometimes when people like myself have this disease, we actually hear static. So if you were asking me these sets of questions that you're asking me back in 1992, I might hear, and then I'd look at you like, what are you doing?
Right.
The brain is that smart. It changes your hearing. And it also, a very, very small kept secret, it also changes your sight.
Yeah.
Your brain will take someone's face who you find threatening and make it fuzzy. Like you see in the media when people don't want to show the actual face.
Exactly.
Your brain will do that with your eyes, and it will scratch with your ears to keep you, to shield you from what it doesn't feel you're ready to take. It is phenomenal. I don't go around bragging that I have this disease, but I definitely think the brain is phenomenal.
Well, it is, and you know, the reality is that you had to be ready to recognize that you were actually married to your assailant, and that's a whole bunch of stuff to be ready for. Tracy, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about the time that you discovered that the feds were interested in your husband. We're going to take a break, folks, and we'll be right back. I said I was going to talk to you about the Fed's interest in your husband, but actually, you've written a book entitled Undeterred, KK Target, KKK Witness. And you go into more detail about that experience in your book. I'd like to instead shift over to your experience with the Klan and how you became exposed to them and what those experiences were like. You met the Grand Dragon at one point, but at the time that you met the Grand Dragon, you didn't realize who the Grand Dragon was. Did you know what the Grand Dragon was?
It's kind of funny. The Klan explained who their Grand Dragon was. I mean, I'm from Indianapolis. I mean, I'm black, I'm female, I'm a West Point graduate, I've been in the military, I'm coming home, this is another place in the United States of America to me. And no, I don't know what a Grand Dragon is. I mean, it sounded like, you know, a porcelain figure you keep on your dining room table. I don't know what the Grand Dragon is, to be honest with you. And I don't know who he is, but I had actually been sent to talk to him, and the man who was the Grand Dragon told me that I should quit my job as a pharmaceutical sales rep. He was a doctor, and he told me I was not welcome to be a pharmaceutical sales rep in Bloomington, Indiana. And the reason why the Klan explained to me is that they look at women as being lower. They look at blacks as being lower than their white women, and they look at the black woman as being even lower than the black male. They don't want to accept sales information and conversation with a black woman that cuts too deep for them, and they want me to quit my job rather than keep calling on all these Klan doctors. There's a lot of Klan doctors in Bloomington. A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
In Bloomington.
Bloomington, Indiana is the headquarters for the Indiana Ku Klux Klan.
There's not much to be said about that other than it is what it is, right?
It is what it is. So when I didn't quit, the Grand Dragon's son, who's now the Grand Dragon himself, I mean, the Grand Dragon's son became the next Grand Dragon. All the things that they did to me, they pretty much tortured my ability to remain in town and to keep my job. But I dutifully went into shop and just kept doing my job. And when they couldn't get me they couldn't scare me enough to get me to leave, and Pfizer finally saved me and moved me, the Grand Dragon, who was his father's son, he actually came after me anyway, or sent Klansmen after me anyway, because even though I wasn't in town anymore, he did that because he was afraid that when I came out of shock, everybody knew that I had PTSD. Everybody knew that I had the social media because they're doctors. So they know if they get in my face and scream at me and holler at me and push me and I keep smiling and acting normal, they know that's not a good response.
Right.
They know I'm sick. So what he was afraid of is when I did come out of shock, I'd write a book.
Tracy?
Yeah.
You've written a book.
Precisely. I wrote the book anyway.
So, and in this book, you go into great detail about what's happened to you, how it happened. You even name names. I don't know if they're real names or names to protect the guilty, but are you safe?
Generally, I'll be honest with you. I've been told by Clancy that you're safe for a couple of years. But there are, if you look on the internet, you won't find any books about the Klan. What they usually do is take the book from the writer by threat, and they kill the writer. Go to the internet and query victim, Klan, Ku Klux Klan, or just Ku Klux Klan. All you're going to find are history books that people write. People like me who write these books, the Klan eventually tries to get them. And they try to take the book. And once they take the book, they hurt the person. They don't want books in circulation about them and what they do to people. But what I'm telling you is the things that happen to me are so well planned out by doctors, lawyers, real estate agents, politicians. It's so well planned what they do to people. People need to read it in order to understand how organized the organized crime is.
Well, Tracy, give us a tiny thumbnail sketch of what did happen to you.
Trying to think of which one is the shortest. this is pretty short. When I was in Bloomington, the Klan will use realtors, and they'll use realtors and they'll use locksmiths to gain keys to people's houses. And if you have, I'm actually putting out something on this for a magazine, but if you have an alarm system, they have a system to go around your alarm system. Believe it or not, they can disable your alarm system while you're sleeping and walk right into your house. And so what happened to me was, when I was working, this particular Klansman was going in my house with a key, and they were putting, they popped little holes. When you drink a soda, have you noticed what, when you're drinking the soda, there's a hole for you to put your mouth and you drink the soda? Exact opposite of that hole on the other side of the can. Have you ever looked at that part of the can before in your life?
Probably not.
That's where they put a hole, and they put a syringe in there, and they put something in, they put a drug into your soda so that you will slowly, as you normally drink, gather that drug in your system. And they were doing that to me, and I found the hole. And I went around telling everybody, hey, distribution cans, this cans that are distributed in Bloomington are tainted. There's a hole in the back of this. Look, there's a hole in the back of my soul. I'm doing this not understanding that the people I'm talking to already knew what was going on.
And I would think that people who didn't know what was going on would just look at you and say, well, she's paranoid, and dismiss it.
Right. My sodas were so metallic in flavor. And what happened was, I would get sodas in the filling station, and it would taste great. But when I went home, all of my sodas were metallic. And I couldn't figure it out.
How did
when
you?
When I found that hole.
Okay.
When I found that hole, I knew why. And so to save them, because I had no beef with them. They were hateful people, but I thought they were angry because they were cooped up in offices all the time. I didn't know why they were so hateful to me. They were always hateful to me. And I just tried to help them, which was kind of funny, because I was trying to help the Klan with the Klan's own ruse. They do that to people. They do things using medical or legal knowledge in order to hurt people.
So as we are talking about this today, you've been through so much trauma in your life, it's almost hard to wrap one brain around it. And now what we're talking about your experiences with the Klan. You've now done something that, I mean, you've kind of exposed a couple of, in a lot of ways, tried and true institutions. You've talked about some challenges at West Point, although you appreciate West Point, and you don't at all say that everybody is bad at West Point, but you do talk about some challenges that exist at West Point. You clearly don't appreciate the Klan. We can understand that, and talk about the challenges of the Klan. So you've got two, you know, huge institutions, and you're kind of pulling the covers back. How do you move forward feeling safe in your home, in your life, in your future? What do you need to do for yourself to feel safe?
Well, first of all, I think that anybody who has PTSD or dissociative amnesia should always seek professional help. And I have sought help from the Veterans Administration Hospital since 2000. After 17 years that I've been in their care, and I'll stay in their care unless I leave state. And you talk through fears. Now, it's funny you say that, because you know your body, when it has extreme fear, shuts down. But yet, when you can sense fear, you talk through fears with your doctors. And that's for anybody. Everybody has to do that if they have these diseases. And so you do that. And then also, I am continuing to write. I wrote another book, although it's not done yet. But and I keep thinking of ways to get my book in more people's hands. I think there's a lot of things that people can learn from my book. And so I'm working on that. I work on work, like my J-O-B, my job, I work on that. I'm going to South Africa to do an international speaking engagement. So I'm working on that. I hope to get more speaking engagements from that. And to me, the way I serve the sort of, we focus on duty, honor, country at West Point. Duty, honor, country. It's a big thing to the West Pointer. And the way I can serve the country and those people around me is through writing and speaking. And being of service. And so I will continue to do that. And, you know, to me, the Klan hurting me right now just means my book is really true. it just means that she hit the nail on the head. And there's a lot that I say about them and their institution and their way of life. I don't judge it or anything. I just explain it so that people understand this is what's growing in our country. This belief set is what's kind of gaining steam, and people should know what it looks like, because the biggest people to lose, you think, are minorities and Jewish people and Catholics, and you think that, but also a big group to lose if the Klan takes hold of more and more power in our country are white women.
It's true.
Big gun for white women. So white women, if no one else in this country read my book, you would think minorities and religious minorities would. But if no one else reads it, white women should read my book.
Interesting. Tracy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and I truly hope that you will stay in touch and let us know when your next book is available so that you can come back on Mind Talk and talk some more.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Tracy, you have a website where folks can get information about Undeterred?
Yeah, it's Tracy, T-R-A-C-E-Y, and then Brame, B-R-A-M is Mike E, TracyBrame.com, and you can find out information.
Wonderful. That's great. Thank you so much. That's, again, folks, that's TracyBrame.com. Tracy, again, I thank you so much for your time today and for your work as you created Undeterred, KKK Target, KKK Witness. Folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand by going to mindtalk.org. or downloading it from the iTunes Store, or downloading the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or Google Play. And that's MYNDTALK, Mind Talk. And again, the website is mindtalk.org. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So send me an email with your questions, your comments. Let me know where you are. And that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mynDTALK.org. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.